Well, there are so many Red Sox players hobbling around the disabled list right now that to diehard fans, it's got to start feeling as if the team's a little cursed. Not that the Sox aren't familiar with curses. One of them goes back almost a century, back to when this version of Tessie, a favorite Sox anthem, rose from the bleachers at Fenway Park. That old-time hex is, of course, the curse of the Bambino. But our guest today says the team had its troubles well before Sox management decided to sell Babe Ruth to the New York Yankees in 1920. Tom Whalen is an associate professor of social science at Boston University, and he's written a new history of the earliest days of the Red Sox. The forthcoming book is titled Before the Curse: Smokey Joe, the Babe, the Evil Genie, and the Boston Red Sox Dynasty of 1912 to 1918. Tom Whalen, welcome to Radio Boston.
My pleasure.
So why don't we start, take us back, actually, to those early days and remind me, how is it that the Sox came to Boston in the first place?
Well, Boston is known for sports, politics, and revenge, and really was a combination of all three factors. The National League was well established here in the 19th century, and Boston was kind of the epicenter of Major League Baseball. But there was this new upstart league called the American League, started by Ban Johnson. And he was upset that the National League was trying to conspire to put him out of business by putting another league in play to in American League cities to basically bankrupt him. And he said, I'll get them. And he decided, I'm going to put a franchise in Boston, show them. And he had no initial desire to do so, but he just did it out of spite. And that's how we got the Red Sox.
The team was founded out of spite.
Exactly. It's perfect. Boston, it fits in perfectly with Boston history.
Well, what about the Fenway itself? It opened in 1912, so its centennial is coming up here in just over a year. But if I understand, correct me if I have my dates right, its opening was actually overshadowed by the sinking of the Titanic.
Right. That's kind of appropriate given the Red Sox's long, tragic history. Just when, you know, everyone is celebrating this brand new park, it was at the time state of the art, concrete and steel. Everyone's excited about it. Oh, yes, you have this incredible disaster, kind of like the 9/11 of the day. And that depressed attendance somewhat for the opening day festivities.
Mm-hmm. So, and what about the person, as you mentioned, who was responsible for bringing the franchise to Boston? John Taylor, can you tell us a little bit more about him?
Well, John Taylor, actually, he was the second main owner of the Red Sox. He was the son of the Boston Globe publisher. And he was the one who actually named them the Red Sox. They were known pretty much as the Boston Americans, and also a nickname was the Pilgrims. And the Boston National League team, they decided to change their home colors from red to blue. And Taylor decided, well, let's seize upon that because, you know, the Red Sox were wearing kind of blue stockings at the time. We'll put them in red stockings and call them the Red Sox. And the Red Sox, the original Red Sox, go back to the 19th century, and they were one of the dominant teams. And the original National League team was called the Red Stockings. And they are linked to the initial Cincinnati Red Stockings, the first professional team in baseball.
Mm-hmm. You write that John Taylor was a bit of a wayward son. His father, General Charles H. Taylor, again, the connection with the Boston Globe there, gave him some $145,000 to buy the baseball team to give young John a sense of purpose.
He was the George W. Bush of his day, right. And he was a screw-up, and he loved to just frequent the bars and the social scene here. And given that he spent so much of his time attending baseball games, anyway, his father said, all right, let's get him this team. And he was really kind of a loose cannon as an owner. I mean, he would barge into the locker room after losses and berate the team, and he'd get very personal. And the club members would say, geez, how does he know that I go to so-and-so place at night, and how does he know I'm dating so-and-so? He was a really kind of vicious, kind of nasty guy, and he was also very much of a drinker. So I think that was not a too stable situation for all considered.
Okay, so we have a team founded out of spite. We have the Fenway opening at the same time the Titanic sinks.
Alcoholic kind of owner,
we
party
have
boy.
The George W. Bush of the 19-teens. So maybe not the most auspicious start for the Sox in Boston. But what about the team themselves? I mean, from 1912 to 1918, they were actually doing pretty well. But in what was going on in the dugout between players, not so harmonious.
Well, it reflected Boston as a whole at the time, major sectarian differences between Protestant players and Catholic players, and particularly the Irish Catholic players on the team. And this reflected Boston society as a whole. The Protestant establishment was not really welcoming of the newcomers, the new immigrants to American society. And in particular, Hall of Famer Tris Speaker, he hated anyone of non-Protestant birth. And he was basically a product of a Confederate family, and he was kind of violent, and he hated Babe Ruth, for example, because he was a Catholic. Babe Ruth, after taking batting practice one day, went back to his locker the next day and found his bats were sawed in half.
Sawed in half.
And yes, sawed in half, and you know they would call him the big baboon behind his back. And he also got into a near fist fight with Smokey Joe Wood, who was the big pitcher of the day. He won 34 games in 1912. And actually, the player manager, Bill Ruff Carrigan of Maine, he was also the catcher. He was only about 5'8", but he took on Speaker, was much bigger physically than him, and beat him in a fist fight to establish his authority. And Carrigan also was Catholic, and that's how bad it got. But what they were able to do was, given their high level of skills on the playing field, they were able to come to some sort of truce that, you know, they didn't hang out with each other off the playing field, but they were able to win when it counts between the lines. And it's interesting that Tris Speaker, who I mentioned, he was also a self-proclaimed member of the Ku Klux Klan, and he was playing between two Catholic great ball players, Duffy Lewis in left and Harry Hooper, who was also a Hall of Famer in right. And he went an entire season without even talking to them.
And you write that, I know this might be hard to believe, but you write that Tris Speaker, as you mentioned, he got traded to Cleveland, I believe, in 1916. And that was considered a bigger loss than Babe Ruth in 1920?
Well, that's what I would argue, because Tris Speaker, pound for pound, is probably the greatest Sox player in history, more so than Ted Williams. And if they had kept Tris Speaker, they probably would have won 6 world championships in a row. As it was, they won 4 in 7 years, but they only won 2 with Speaker. And think about that. If Speaker stayed with the team, there would have been no need to move Babe Ruth into the outfield. And Babe Ruth would have just ended up the greatest left-handed pitcher in baseball history. And we would not have had, say, for example, a Black Sox scandal of 1919. Mm-hmm. The Red Sox would have gone down as probably one of the greatest dynasties of all time.
All right. So you've brought up the Bambino himself. And, you know, we mentioned the curse at the beginning. But you, and there are others as well, but you don't buy it that this is the actual curse of the Red Sox. What is the real curse in your mind?
The real curse is bad management and just institutional racism.
That lasted for decades.
And right. They had first dibs on players like Jackie Robinson, Willie Mays. I mean, you can imagine playing alongside Ted Williams, those two players. But Tom Yawkey just had non-progressive views when it came to matters of race. They're the last team to integrate in the major leagues. They waited till 1959 to have a black ball player. And that's basically on the eve of the Kennedy administration. Hmm. That is just embarrassing. But I think the organization as a whole, they embraced the notion of this supernatural curse because it was far easier for them to explain off why they were so unsuccessful on the field. Well, yes, there's this supernatural curse, so you can't blame us. You know, the fact that we're incompetent and the fact that we have a bunch of racists running the team. So I think the curse was, you know, it's a wonderful sounding kind of myth, but it's not based in reality at all.
Yeah, in fact, if I remember correctly, they had first dibs, as you mentioned, on Jackie Robinson, even gave him something of
a tryout, which
but
was
a
sham.
It was a bit of a, yeah, because just management was there. They didn't really take it very seriously. They just did it to get it out of the way.
Well, there was a local counselor and city counselor here in Boston who basically was threatening, you know, their ability to play on Sunday afternoon games. So he kind of put the political pressure on them to stage the tryout, and they reluctantly did. But even Jackie Robinson, he was, for the rest of his life, he was just really angry. Because I think he wanted to play in Boston. He really liked Boston, but he just realized he was being used for political purposes here.
Mm-hmm. And we found a video on the web, and there's a link to it at our website, wbur.org/Boston, of Ted Williams himself when he was inducted into the Hall of Fame, you know, saying that he hoped that one day, he was inducted obviously many years ago, that one day fellow black players would be able to get the same recognition that he did. So he was obviously very conscious of the Sox history as he was living it.
He sure was. And in many ways, Ted Williams helped open the door, the Hall of Fame, to athletes of color, because they, before that speech, they were very reluctant to give the so-called Negro Leagues of the 30s and the 40s any representation in the hallowed halls of Cooperstown.
Well, we've come a long way since then. In the last couple seconds we have here, the curse, has it been lifted? The curse of bad management?
Well, it has a circular effect, a boomerang effect. I think we'll have periods of good and bad management here.
All right. Well, that is Tom Whalen. He is Associate Professor of Social Science at Boston University and the author of the forthcoming book, Before the Curse, Smokey Joe, the Babe, the Evil Genie, and the Boston Red Sox Dynasty of 1912 to 1918. Tom Whalen, thanks so much for that early history of the Sox.
Thank you.
Coming up, another Harvard academic is headed to Washington. President Barack Obama has tapped Dr. Donald Berwick, a Boston-based professor, doctor, and healthcare reform advocate, to head the Medicare and Medicaid agencies. He actually did a congressional recess appointment today. Stay with us. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is Radio Boston.
Charge into the park, storm the gates and put the